The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine, we revisit once again Kid of the Year Time, dated February 28/March 7, 2022. Orion Jean, 11, the boy, or maybe it's Jean, 11, the boy is seated here in a portrait for his Time Magazine Kid of the Year. It's a red cover in gradations, actually, to orange, with the outer border in bright red, the more slim white inner border, and Time superimposed in a light orange beige color in large block capital letters. Orion's wearing black pants, white high tops, a white shirt with a long-sleeved, rolled up to the elbow, plaid shirt in shades of blue and yellow. He's a child of color, a person of color, with very short black hair, very bright dark eyes. He's wearing glasses, and he's smiling brightly. And at his feet, on this pedestal in which he is seated, there is a bouquet of what appear to be wild flowers in multiple colors, with a pale blue bow tying the stems together. Beginning now with articles from this magazine. Climate, on the front lines of climate change. The U.S. military says it wants to reduce emissions, but it is not built to do that, by Alejandro de la Garza. Illustration by Taylor Callery. And that's Callery for Time. It's a khaki-colored tank-type vehicle in dull shades of khaki and gray and brown. It has antenna on it. It's a track vehicle. I'm not sure if I'm properly calling it a tank or not. But here we go with the text. November 2020. A flatbed truck pulled onto the Sterling Heights, Michigan campus of military contractor BAE Systems and unloaded two huge lozenge-shaped Bradley vehicles, especially delivery from the U.S. Army. Workers moved the vehicles into a garage and began pulling them apart, swapping in smaller gasoline engines, electric motors, and a new lithium-ion battery. The exact battery capabilities are a military secret. The result, a hybrid electric troop transport, is best likened to a 28-ton Prius, plus tank treads, a turret, and a 25-millimeter cannon, all with an expected 10% to 20% improvement in fuel economy. The Army is getting greater capability, dependability, survivability with hybrid electric drive, says Jim Miller, head of business development at BAE's Combat Systems Division. And then they get the environmental impact. To be clear, even a hybrid electric Bradley is about as friendly to the environment as it is to anyone on the wrong end of its Bushmaster chain gun. The electric upgrade could push fuel economy close to 0.9 miles per gallon from 0.75 before. But the improvement could amount to substantial fuel savings and accompanying emissions reductions across all U.S. forces, especially if BAE is able to apply its hybrid technology to other armored vehicles, as the company hopes. Military vehicles, along with the forces that use them and the industries that supply them, represent a huge climate problem, accounting for 5% of the world's carbon emissions every year. And there's no bigger actor in that space than the U.S. military, which sucks up more petroleum than any other institution on Earth to fly jets, heat buildings, ferry food and supplies to 750 bases spread across the world, a process that, all told, produces an emissions footprint greater than that of the entire country of Sweden. That might be changing, though. The Department of Defense, DOD, has embarked on a decarbonization push in recent months, claiming to be in the process of building a greener American fighting force. But many environmentalists and academics say that fully decarbonizing the country's current military and its vast network of overseas bases simply is not realistic. Carbon cuts, they argue, will come with trade-offs, and at some point we will have to make a difficult choice to scale down our armed forces to avert ecological catastrophe. The U.S. military has actually been talking about climate change for a long time, even as the issue has fallen in and out of political favor. Almost two decades ago, for instance, when the Bush administration was still denying human-caused climate change was real, the DOD's Office of Net Assessment commissioned a controversial 2003 report on how rising temperatures could affect U.S. national security. Many more reports have followed, with strategists and planners routinely studying how a changing climate will impact the military's mission. In general, most of those initiatives have focused either on climate adaptation, finding ways to protect military installations like Navy bases from rising seas and extreme weather, or on a changing geostrategic landscape like new theaters of conflict in newly opened Arctic waterways. What has not been discussed much is the prospect of actually reducing the DOD's own substantial carbon footprint. During the Obama administration, Congress created a new Pentagon office that seemed positioned to do just that, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy. But although the purview of the new role did touch on climate change, its primary impetus was to reduce fuel expenses during the costly Afghanistan and Iraq wars, as well as to cut the required number of fuel transport convoys, which were vulnerable to attack by the Taliban and other enemy insurgents. Sharon Burke, appointed to the position in 2010, worked on incorporating new renewable energy technologies into field operations and tried to get issues of energy usage factored into military planning and strategies, although she was sometimes stymied by a military structure resistant to change. "I used to call it affable noncompliance," she says. The operational energy position lost influence under the Trump administration, but some important Obama-era initiatives remained in place, including a 2016 DOD directive outlining internal policies and roles to assess and manage risks associated with the impacts of climate change. Not much happened under that directive during the Trump administration, but it was still technically in effect. And when the Biden administration came in, it provided an institutional framework to build on to turn the military bureaucracy's attention toward climate change. Now, a year into the Biden presidency, the military's emissions messaging has undergone an unprecedented shift. Defense Department appointees have started talking about emissions cuts, while the Pentagon has sent out inquiries to companies about emissions accounting and reporting and supplying government facilities with renewable energy. In September, the DOD released a climate adaptation plan that stated the need to begin considering emissions in all the department's strategies and policies. Still, the Biden administration has avoided imposing hard limits on DOD emissions. In a December executive order, President Biden pledged to cut the federal government's carbon footprint to zero by 2050. but exempted anything related to national security. Some liberal lawmakers objected to the carve-out, pointing out the military has accounted for between 77% and 80% of federal energy use over the past two decades. And to make matters even less certain, a future GOP administration could reverse any of Biden's green efforts. Stopping here to relay to you a photograph. Defense contractors are developing lower emission offerings, like the EV concept from GM Defense. This is a big, I think it's big anyway, green Jeep. It's got four wheels on it. I would say it's an extra long bed, and there are seats inside for, I think, four people with some guns attached. This is a very open-looking vehicle. I do not see doors on it, nor a roof. And that's where the doors and the roof spaces accommodate this artillery. But it doesn't look bad here because it's parked on a nice green lawn with lots of green trees behind it. There are additional gasoline tanks on what is an extension of the truck bed. And back to the text, still some military branches are pushing ahead. The Army, for instance, released a new climate strategy February 8, declaring its intention to go net zero by 2050. Some green technology projects have picked up steam, with military contractors building out new offerings in hopes of cashing in on the climate momentum, although some projects are still only in the early stages of a long and complex process of actually integrating them into the military's operations. In May, the Army hosted a demonstration at Fort Benning, Georgia, for potential electric reconnaissance vehicle concepts. The branch is planning for all non-combat vehicles to be electric by 2035 and to start using electric tactical vehicles by 2050. The Air Force, meanwhile, has started querying suppliers about providing new, more efficient, adaptive cycle engines for its combat fighters. In many cases, though, the military's impetus for rolling out greener technologies is really less about climate concerns than about getting better at the armed forces' main job, fighting. Those adaptive cycle engines, for example, will give Air Force fighters a 25% range boost. And while new hybrid electric drive systems being developed for naval warships could have some fuel economy benefits, they also help supply more electricity to power new laser weapons and powerful radar systems. EVs and concepts like the hybrid Bradley could cut Army emissions, but they also reduce its reliance on vulnerable fuel supply lines to support its far-flung bases. In some sense, it is a good thing. Some of those green technologies are a win-win for fighting ability and the climate. But it also shows the military is not interested in emissions reductions that run counter to its broader aims. Jack Sourush, who serves under the unwieldy title of Senior Official Performing the Duties of Assistant Army Secretary for Installations, Energy, and Environment, has hinted as much. Climate change and its effects obviously pose a very serious threat, he said, speaking at the annual meeting of the Association of the U.S. Army in October. But I want to stress that climate change does not alter the Army's overall mission, which is to deploy, fight, and win. Joe Bryan, senior climate advisor to the Secretary of Defense and the Defense Department's chief sustainability officer, was more blunt. DOD's mission is to provide the military forces needed to deter war and ensure our nation's security, he wrote in a statement to Time. We will never compromise on that. On a video call, Kenneth Agee, A-G-E-E, perhaps it's Agee, held up a plastic cylinder filled with a white waxy substance. You think of crude oil as black, he said, but this is synthetic crude. It is white as snow. AG is founder and president of an Oklahoma-based company called Emerging Fuels Technology, which helped produce jet fuel from carbon dioxide in the air as part of an Air Force demonstration project last August. For the project, engineers at a startup called 12 shipped AG a tank of carbon monoxide that they had made using atmospheric CO2 and electricity. Emerging Fuels Technology then fed that gas through its own process, combining it with hydrogen, which can be produced either from methane or from water using electricity, to generate synthetic crude, full of long hydrocarbon strings like those found in crude oil. To produce a mixture of hydrocarbons similar to those in jet fuel, they put that substance through a cracking process, akin to a miniature oil refinery, then poured a gallon of it into a glass jar and shipped it off to scientists at the Air Force for further study. The Air Force says a 50-50 mix of that fuel and petroleum could be used in aircraft and has expressed optimism that units in the field could use synthetic jet fuel made in this way, although it says there are still unanswered questions, like where those soldiers would get the electricity needed to power the process in the field. Another fuel plant using EFT's part of the technology and supported by the Air Force, but with biomass instead of carbon monoxide as a primary input, is under construction in Oregon, but the project has endured multiple delays and financing problems. If it's completed, that plant would be able to turn out 16 million gallons of fuel a year, less than 1% of the approximately 2 billion gallons of jet fuel the Air Force uses annually. That was 2 billion gallons. Supplying the whole Air Force, not to mention Army and Navy aircraft, and a commercial aviation sector would require many hundreds of such plants, an entirely new industrial sector built from scratch. Military aviation accounts for about 70% of all the DoD's energy use, and to some researchers, the implications are obvious. The only way to reduce fuel use is to reduce how often jets are flying, says Heidi Peltier, director of programs at Brown University's Costs of War Project. That, she says, means the military cannot maintain its globe-spanning presence and become carbon neutral at the same time. A sustainable military will have to be smaller, with fewer bases, fewer troops to feed and clothe, fewer ships and airplanes ferrying supplies to personnel from Guam to Germany. That reduction could have climate co-benefits with all the public money currently being spent on EV Hummers and hybrid tanks, potentially redirected to projects to help build America's sorely lacking green infrastructure, like renewable energy and production, EV charging stations, and public transportation. Doug Weir, research and policy director at the UK-based Conflict and Environmental Observatory, says the military will have to bite the bullet eventually and start reducing fuel use in ways that do not necessarily have strategic upsides. There's going to have to be a point where they make emissions cuts because there is a climate emergency which is going to destabilize the planet and human civilization, he says. That idea, making emissions cuts that run counter to U.S. strategic interests, is laughable to some military strategists because it would amount to an intentional weakening of military strength abroad. Electrification for the military has to be something that's operationally valuable rather than being strictly for the purposes of climate change, says Brian Clark, a fellow at the conservative-leaning Hudson Institute. Your opponents are not going to unilaterally disarm. From the Pentagon's point of view, the U.S. does not have a choice but to maintain a powerful force to engage in international confrontations like the current standoff in Ukraine. Nobody wants war, but you don't always get to choose, says Burke, the former Obama administration official. They say in the military, the enemy gets a vote. Some researchers say emissions implications of conflict need to be a bigger consideration as the U.S. chooses how to meet those threats. But as climate change ratchets up tensions around the world, some worry that nations will further militarize in response, creating a vicious cycle of military emissions. You cannot win a climate change war, says Nick Buxton, a researcher at the Amsterdam-based Transnational Institute. Our atmosphere observes no boundaries. It is just obvious that that nationalist approach in the end will not serve us. The U.S. can choose one of two courses: to completely recast its military mindset for the sake of emissions cuts, or else just slot some greener tech into its massive war machine, like a $700 billion Bradley tank with a new hybrid engine. For now, it appears set on the latter. Defense budgets are sacrosanct in Congress, and in the most recent defense authorization bill passed in December, legislators forbade the Defense Department from closing even U.S. bases the Pentagon had deemed to be unnecessary. Even if some representatives agreed to give up economically precious bases in their districts, it is not as if anyone in the White House or the DOD is talking seriously about pulling back deployments to counter a bellicose Russia and an increasingly powerful China. Still, in recent months, emissions moves from the Defense Department have at least come as a long overdue acknowledgement that the military's climate footprint is a serious issue, even if they do not seem to be quite getting into the root of the matter. I liken it to Alcoholics Anonymous, says Weir. The first step is admitting that you have a problem. Now to Time Off Movies, a review, Where is the Love, for the Lowly Werewolf. This is by Stephanie Zakarik. The werewolf movie may be a horror staple, but the sad reality is that compared with vampires, our furry-fanged friends lag in popularity by a moonlit country mile. Werewolves do not ignite the erotic imagination like vampires do. Voraciousness is not as sexy as neck-biting. But there's still poetry to be found in the idea of doomed beings stuck in a cycle of perpetual hunger. The Cursed, written and directed by English filmmaker Sean Ellis, is not a werewolf picture in the strict sense. There's nothing shaggy or wolf-like about the beasts in question, but they are, as the title suggests, beings brought to life by a deadly bite, their unearthly cravings and affliction foisted upon them by an unnamed ancient spirit. Set somewhere in 19th century France, this is a movie low on cheap jump scares and high on atmosphere. Its polished gloominess is one of its chief attributes, situating you in a time and place where you don't feel quite right in your own skin. The trouble starts when wealthy landowner Seamus Laurent, Alistair Petrie, rounds up a bunch of thugs to murder a group of Romani families who claim his land really belongs to them. The goons notice the elderly Roma matriarch, Pascale Becousse, has in her possession a set of silver false teeth, each sharp little spike marked with a cross. They decide the things are too scary to seize and melt down. Before they kill and bury the old woman, she hisses a warning. We will poison your sleep until you summon the Dark One. Then you will know what death is. And before you know it, Laurent's children, sweet-natured Edward, Max McIntosh, and his protective older sister Charlotte, Amelia Crouch, begin having nightmares. They dream of a human scarecrow, by far the movie's most horrifying image, and of that set of silver choppers. It is only a matter of time before Edward, Charlotte, and the other kids of the village make their way to the site of the massacre, where the old woman's curse takes its full, grisly effect. The Cursed is your classic cautionary tale about the price of greed and bigotry. and less an allegory about the unruliness of nature, still, in most werewolf lore, it seems that young people, like poor sweet Edouard Laurent, are more susceptible to mystical wolf power than adults are. Werewolfdom is sometimes a manifestation of adolescent confusion, of bodily changes that are bewildering and scary. That is how we got movies like the 1957 teeny bopper fave, I Was a Teenage Werewolf, and it's a factor in the Twilight movies as well. Taylor Lautner's Jacob Black is the werewolf boy that Kristen Stewart's Bella Swan just cannot resist. Then there's John Fawcett's brilliant 2000 Ginger Snaps, in which a goth teenager is attacked and transformed by a wild beast on the same day she starts menstruating. The movie's tagline, "They don't call it the curse for nothing," says it all. The werewolves of the cursed are different. They carry the weight of history and of discrimination on their hunched shoulders. At one point before her death, the Roma Grande Dame explains the bargain she and her people have made with the beastly spirit behind the curse in question. "We have protected it for generations, and it has protected our generations." There is nothing cuddly about the weird creatures of the cursed, but there is no question that they get the job done. And another review here. This is Pie in the Sky for Justin Nickel, also by Zakarik. The heart of a city may beat loudest in its restaurants, the places where people gather to eat and drink, to gossip and celebrate. In New York City and Philadelphia for some 80 years, the horn and hard art automats were perhaps the best measure of the pulse of city life. According to first-time filmmaker Lisa Hurwitz's delightful documentary, The Automat, the idea of automating, where individual items sat behind little windows, purchased by dropping nickels in a slot, would become the hallmark of a chain that existed only in two cities, but whose cultural reach was vast. During the Depression, a cup of coffee and a slice of pie cost just a few nickels at Horn and Hardart, providing sustenance and pleasure for city dwellers stretched thin. The coffee would flow from an elegant spout shaped like a dolphin. Co-founder Joseph Horn got his inspiration from an Italian fountain, thus bringing a touch of European elegance to diner's daily cup of joe. Everyone, black or white, rich or poor, was welcome at Horn and Hardart, as Hurwitz's subjects attest. They include Colin Powell, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Mel Brooks, who so adored the automat that he wrote a song about it, which he performs over the film's closing credits. Because the last Horn and Hardart closed in 1991, that 5-cent cup of coffee now exists only in his dreams. But at least he can share its glory with us. Another review by Zakarik. Andy Garcia brings the gold to an idiosyncratic indie movie. The 1990s and early 2000s were a golden era of odd but ambitious little American indies, like Burr Steer's Igby Goes Down and George Wong's Swimming with Sharks. They may not have been perfect, but at least they had chutzpah on their side. Fewer of those movies find their way into the mainstream today, but Brian Petzos' wonky comedy Big Gold Brick shows a similarly idiosyncratic go-for-broke spirit. Its low-key eccentricity, driven by an affably capricious performance from Andy Garcia, is its greatest pleasure. Aspiring writer Samuel Emery Cohen has already found great success at being a loser. He's about to be tossed out of his apartment, and he's had it with life. After stumbling out onto a dark road, he's hit by a car. Behind the wheel is middle-aged gent Floyd Garcia, distracted because he's shoveling frozen custard into his mouth while driving. Floyd rushes Samuel to the hospital, and as the young man recovers from injuries, which appear to have affected his brain, or at least his sense of reality, Floyd wonders if this wannabe author might be of use to him. He signs Samuel up to write his biography, offering a stipend of $500 a week, and ensconcing him in his flashy suburban home, replete with a maladjusted teenage son, Leonidas Castrunas, a kind but emotionally fragile daughter, Lucy Hale, and a libidinous second wife, Megan Fox. Floyd, who favors trim blazers spruced up with devil-may-care pocket squares, is a classy guy with money. Or is he? Samuel does not have the best grip on things, but he begins to sense something's amiss, and his encounter with a villainous zillionaire, Oscar Isaac, intentionally hamming it up, proves him right. Big gold brick, maybe a bit too enamored with its own quirkiness, but everything Garcia does, no matter how outlandish, feels perfectly natural. Arriving at the hospital with flowers for Samuel, he dumps the cotton swabs out of a glass jar without even looking, missing nary a beat. He needs a vase. Who cares about dumb old swabs? His comic timing is as suave as Floyd's ascots, as understated as his darkly paneled office. Sometimes it's the small showcase that serves actors best. Time Off Books, Sabah Tahir, On the Edge of a Desert, by Sonia Mansour. Sabah, S-A-B-A-A, Tahir, T-A-H-I-R, still remembers when a classmate at her high school in California's Mojave Desert probed her about whether she had a green card. The Pakistani-American author remembers countless mispronunciations of her name, for which I apologize if I am one of them. She remembers violent threats. Tahir's family owned an 18-room motel off the main road of their isolated, majority-white town. Her parents' accents and the family's religious traditions made them different. "We felt it every day," says Tahir, now 38. "The things kids said to me at school, asking questions that indicated not just a lack of knowledge, but disdain. That feeling of being othered runs through Tahir's latest young adult novel, All My Rage, out March 1, which closely follows two Muslim Pakistani-American teenagers, Noor and Salahuddin, as they navigate grief, faith, love, and trauma while coming of age in a desert community where isolation is not only a matter of geography. So many of us who feel marginalized, we hold all this anger inside, and we cannot express it without potentially serious consequences," Tahir says. Her characters know the feeling well, and the result is a book that brings readers closer than ever to the celebrated author's inner world. Tahir broke out with An Ember in the Ashes, a YA fantasy series about teens defying a brutal empire that sold more than 1 million copies. I think she means the series sold 1 million, not the empire. All My Rage is a dramatic departure. The novel, already set to be adapted for television with Tahir co-writing, is her fifth and her most personal one to date. "Writing All My Rage was infinitely more difficult than crafting a fantasy world," she says. "I had to remind myself that I cannot fix these problems with magic." The new book explores exactly what the title declares, rage, not only in response to racism, but also in response to parents who fail to show up. The ways in which addiction unravels relationships, the grief of losing the people who matter. Noor and Salahuddin are high school seniors navigating a turbulent friendship, and maybe more, while learning what it means to be there for each other through hardship. All My Rage travels back and forth in time, telling stories of the teens in present-day California and Salahuddin's parents when they were young in Pakistan. Although the book is nuanced in its inclusion of Pakistani, Muslim, and desert culture, it speaks to something shared by many. the universal experience of being in an inescapable situation where you have no good choices. Tahir took 15 years to write All My Rage. Crafting a story so closely tied to her life was a vulnerable undertaking, and one she pursued largely in private. "It was just this conversation I was having with myself," she says. A motel setting is the most obvious ties to her reality. Tahir's parents worked to hold their business together through difficult economic circumstances while raising three kids. When Tahir was in college, her father had a stroke, and her family sold the motel. She never got closure with a place that had been so important, so she gave Salahuddin and his family a desert inn of their own. "I have never been a person who really thought about things like self-love, but it took a lot of self-love to write this book," she says. "It was like looking back at who I was as a child." She drew from several hard formative experiences. Throughout the book, Salahuddin is disappointed by his father, who's often drunk. He is looking at someone he loves who's just a mess and thinking, "I deserve better than this," says Tahir, who has felt similar emotions. And the loss of a friend turned out to be a key moment in her writing process, solidifying a theme from her life that she knew had to be part of the story. In 2017, a friend of Tahir's overdosed. "Everything I witnessed around that incident, confusion, shame, grief, it had a big impact," she says. "The book allowed me to work out how I felt about things that I had experienced, but in a way that did not feel overwhelming." In YA, wherever there is darkness, there must also be light. For the teens in All My Rage, one source is faith. Tahir aims to portray religion in the most human way possible, showcasing her character's evolving relationships with God. For Noor and Salahuddin, Islam is at once a profound source of comfort, an informal and often funny daily practice, and an aspiration that feels just out of reach. Tahir herself is Muslim and relates to her character's ever-evolving feelings. "I definitely do not think I have it figured out," she says. But she does believe strongly that religion should never be a burden. "It was very important for me to know that a faith offered these kids a way to feel a little less alone." She hopes the book can help readers feel seen. Sometimes it takes a grown-up's perspective to know the value of that kind of peace. Last year, the author returned to the motel for the first time since the mid-2000s with her husband and two children. "I needed to see it," she says. "We went there, and my brain just went quiet." She struggled to find the words to explain to her kids what this place meant. So her husband stepped in, telling them all sorts of facts about the town, which made her realize he had done research of his own. Looking out, Tahir's mind circled back to one thought. "It was crazy how much it had remained the same," she says, "and how much I had changed." Here's a column entitled 11 Questions by Carl Vick. Art Spiegelman, that's S-P-I-E-G-E-L-M-A-N, the cartoonist on a Tennessee school board's move against Mouse, M-A-U-S, his memoir of family and the Holocaust. The school board of, this is the question, the school board of McMinn County, Tennessee, voted January 10 to stop assigning eighth graders to read Mouse, your graphic novel recounting the Holocaust through your family history. Do you take personal offense? Answer, by Art Spiegelman. Yes, but I cannot tell how malevolent they are. Are these people really idiots? Or are they actually sinister forces that have gathered to kill America? I cannot tell to what degree these people carried water for more whacked-out people, the ones who really stand to profit from getting more charter schools in the area that teach religion, thereby making money away from a thereby taking money away from a public education that needs far, far more to do its job well. Question, did you read the minutes of the board meeting? answer several times. Question, the book was removed from a curriculum. Is that a ban? Answer, to use authority to keep people from things, yes, it's a ban, and yet it is not a book burning. Question, did not the burning of comic books launch your career? Answer, the comics code is what made me, yes. The burning of comic books, literally, in the 40s and 50s by teachers, clergymen, parents, focused on the same thing these school board people focus on. We have to protect the children as opposed to educate them. But those comic books that they were burning were getting more far out as they led into the more adult audience. The horror comics and some of the very lurid images in many of those comics were among the comics I loved the most because they were kind of on the edge of the forbidden. They were showing me things to their most exaggerated. Question. These board members said the Holocaust should certainly be taught, and the issue is the curse words and nudity in your book. Do you take them at their word? Answer. My guess is what they did is because the law of the land is based on the 1982 decision that you can ban things for their effect on young minds and whatever, but you cannot on the basis of content. So they focus on how terrible it was to see what they described as a nude woman and what I saw as the naked corpse of my mother in the bathtub, having slashed her wrists in that bathtub. Question, and then you curse out your father for destroying her diary. Can't people object to bad language? Answer, they were upset because I was breaking the commandment to honor thy father. That was usurping their authority. They're all parents. They don't want their kids talking to them like that, thank you. They focused on that because authority is what they like the most. They are authoritarians, damn it. What do you think is actually going on here? Answer, I don't really know. The metaphor I use is, it's like if you saw a psycho killer strangling a loved one of yours and you could not reach that person to stop them. And your only response was, God, did you see the fingernails on that creep's hands? They're dirty. Question. Any chance you will agree, as the board's lawyer suggested, to white out words like bitch? Answer. Maybe we should just put in blintz or bagel. Make for a more wholesome Jewish cultural experience. Question. Your book is on bestseller lists again. Isn't that nice? Isn't that part nice? Answer. Mouse has been really selling steadily since 1986, when the first volume came out. Even more so after it won the Pulitzer Prize. I did not need to boost my income. It'll give me more money to donate to things like voter registration. Question. Have you ever been to Eastern Tennessee? Answer. Never. Question. Would it help to meet these people? Answer. Through bulletproof glass? Yeah. Under the heading World, Hitting the High Mark, How a Remote Himalayan District Achieved an Extraordinary COVID-19 Vaccination Rate by Nilanjana Bhoumik, Uttarakhand, India. On the day he was scheduled for a COVID-19 vaccination, 77-year-old Jay Kishan Ram wrapped himself in a well-worn wool jacket, cap, and sweater to prepare for the three-hour trek down the mountain. To access the main road from his home high in the Himalayan mountains of the Indian state of Uttarakhand, Ram had to first climb down a mile of steep, unpaved, sloping path. From there, it was another 90 minutes on the main road to the village of Padampuri. That is where the only government hospital and walk-in COVID-19 vaccination center in the Dari area, home to some 30,000 people spread across 46 villages, is located. It was early September, and India was still recovering from a devastating second COVID-19 wave, driven primarily by the Delta variant. According to official government figures, more than 400,000 Indians died between June 1, 2020 and July 1, 2021. But a recent report in the journal Science estimates the true toll might have been as high as 3.2 million deaths. The majority of those, 2.7 million, occurred in 3 months, April through June 2021. In the following months, cases of COVID-19 dropped significantly, and hospitalizations remained relatively low, even during an Omicron-driven third wave, which peaked in late January. This is in part thanks to nationwide efforts to stop the virus. India began rolling out COVID-19 vaccines in January 2021, starting with health workers, then for people over 50, and those with comorbidities. It took a while for the vaccine rollout to pick up pace, but by January 30 of this year, India's government said 75% of its adult population had received 2 doses of a COVID-19 vaccine. As a septuagenarian, Ram was eligible early on, but at first he stayed home, uncertain about the safety of the vaccines and wary of the trip he would have to take to get his shots. But months of persistence by health workers in Padampuri, and especially by his daughter-in-law, who's part of Dari's vaccination team, managed to persuade him. "I saw how hard she worked on this," Ram says. "She urged me to take the vaccine, if not for myself, then for my family and the community." His change of heart was not unusual. In this isolated region that spans more than 30 square miles, most of it rugged terrain that rises to 7,000 feet of elevation, by the beginning of October, 100% of eligible adults had received a first vaccine dose. That equates to some 28,000 people, according to Himanshu Kanpal, the chief medical officer of the Dhari, and that's spelled D-H-A-R-I, block, who's in charge of Padampuri's medical center. The state of Uttarakhand as a whole reached that same milestone in mid-October, with all eligible adults, some 7.4 million people, receiving a first dose, usually of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, known locally as Covishield. Those vaccinated in the very first phase typically received Covaxin, India's own vaccine. Although most Indian cities are now catching up, Dari was an early success story and continues to get people to show up, more recently for their second doses and booster shots. As of the time of writing, more than 80% of eligible adults in Dari, one of the most remote places in the world, have received a second dose, despite heavy snowfall and road closures in hilly areas. Kanpal says that by the end of February, the adult population in the region will be fully vaccinated, although it is difficult to be completely certain in an area where officials struggle to document members of every household. All eligible teenagers ages 15 to 17 have also received a first dose. Other districts in the state have had similar successes, as has India's mountainous state of Himachal Pradesh. Indeed, the vaccination rate in many hill districts far outstrips those of richer places with better health infrastructure and where vaccines are widely available. In the U.S., for example, 64.4% of adults have been fully vaccinated as of February 14, while 75.9% have had a first dose. How did a remote Himalayan region manage to succeed, where so many other places have struggled? The answer underscores the value of health workers who are embedded in their communities and know how best to serve them in a crisis. At first glance, Dari seems an unlikely place to hit such a vaccine success milestone. For one thing, the Indian government made a smartphone app the primary means for booking a vaccination appointment. In a country where only around half the population has a smartphone, in rural areas like Dari, that proportion is far lower. Another challenge was simple practicality. Much of the population here lives in remote areas, and it takes them so long to come to the medical center, Kanpal told Time in August, sitting in his office in Padampuri, the only significant medical facility for 25 miles. The building, covered in faded yellow paint, stands atop a mountain slope, approachable only by a long flight of steep stairs carved out of the mountainside. At about 5,200 feet elevation, it is thousands of feet below many of the mountain villages it serves. People have to commit to a full day to get vaccinated. That didn't help, Kanpal said. Hema Devi knows just how difficult that can be. In July, the 45-year-old farmer made the steep, mile-long uphill trek from her home in the remote hamlet of Thiroli to a vaccination camp in the bigger village of Donachuli. She waited for hours for her turn before learning the camp had just run out of vaccines. I hear about people not taking vaccines in the cities, and I'm puzzled, she says. They don't even have to climb a mountain or negotiate broken roads. They also don't have to think of who's going to cook dinner or lunch if they're stuck at the camp. They can just order food on the phone. August 2, she tried again, waking before dawn to cook, clean, and take her buffaloes and goats out to graze before setting off with her husband and two neighbors. When they arrived in Donachuli, Devi and her husband joined different lines to register for their shots. The line for men was much shorter, with most of them, including Devi's husband, there to receive second doses, while most of the women had yet to receive their first. That disparity has persisted across India, in part because of the difficulty in getting time away from housework and child care. According to India's official vaccination website, CoWin, as of February 14, a total of 1.67 billion vaccine doses have been administered in India, 49.5% to women and 50.5% to men, a gap of some 38 million doses. Indeed, when Devi's husband received his first dose in July at the primary health care center in Padampuri, around an hour's drive away, she could not go with him because of home responsibilities. It would have taken the whole day, and who would have taken care of the children and the housework? Even on the day Devi finally received her vaccine, she rushed home after registering at the camp to cook lunch and tend to the livestock while her husband saved her spot. She sprinted back just in time for her shot. I did not want to miss out this time, too, she says. If we run out of vaccines, you never know when we will get it next. Devi was not always so eager to get the vaccine. Like many Dari residents interviewed by Time, she was initially scared. We heard stories of infertility and deaths, she says, but then we saw people taking it, and they were okay. Also, the health workers came to the village and explained and encouraged us. They are one of us, so we trust them. Crucially, these workers have history on their side. The health care workers in Dari are mostly local women who've been trained to act as educators in their communities through work as accredited social health activists, ASHAs, or hired by the government as nurse midwives, ANMs, to act as the first point of contact between the community and the public health care system. Across India, especially in rural areas, these community workers have played a crucial role in the pandemic, creating awareness about the virus, tracking and monitoring cases, then rolling out the vaccination program. In Dari, this well-earned trust led locals to buy into the idea that they needed to get vaccinated to protect themselves and their families against COVID-19, even if it meant trekking hours through steep terrain. September 4, nurse midwife Renu Sharma, a member of Kanpal's team who's been working with the Dari population for 13 years now, traveled with a team of healthcare workers from Padampuri to the remote village of Agaria, There she received a warm welcome. She knew lots of the women by name, having vaccinated their children years earlier, and in a mock stern voice told them to come and get their own COVID-19 vaccines at the camp now. Before the arrival of Sharma and her team, the nearest place for Agaria residents to get vaccinated was the camp in Donanchuli, a tough journey along an unpaved path that could be particularly treacherous whenever rain loosened the rocks and soil. That is why Sharma and her team decided to set up a temporary pop-up vaccination site in Agaria. They were quickly inundated, and by afternoon the line for vaccines continued to grow. While administering shots, Sharma noticed a group of three elderly men who had spent the day sitting at the pop-up vaccination clinic. During a lull in activity, she approached them. "Bubbo, have you registered?" she asked, using a local term of respect, meaning grandfather. The men demurred. "No, no, we came here just to see what's happening," one said. "We don't want to take the vaccine." Undeterred, Sharma continued to press. "Look at me, Bubbo. I was one of the first ones to take the vaccine. Has anything happened to me?" She said. At that point, others in the village who'd gotten a shot joined in, saying they too had suffered no serious side effects. Finally, the men relented. Sharma marched them to the registration table with a triumphant smile and went back to her station to open up another pack of vaccines. "Sometimes you have to persist with them a bit," she said. "I have had to persist for days and weeks with some people." This article was abridged. It was written by Nilanjana Bhoumik Uttarakhand in India, with reporting by Eloise Berry, London. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.